We're going to be looking this evening at verse 17 in Romans 11. If some of the branches were broken off, and you being a wild olive were grafted in among them, and became a partaker with them of the rich root of the olive tree, comma. And then he goes into the problem. When Paul wrote these words to the Gentiles, and he said specifically in verse 13, I am speaking to you who are Gentiles. So what he's having to say, he is saying to specifically the non-Jewish part of the group that made up the church. But he specifies in verse 17 their great privilege as it exists in spite of what we would call their natural condition, because they were branches grafted off of a wild olive tree into the rich fatness of the tree. We would call it a domesticated olive tree, one that was in the olive orchard. But he's deliberately pointing out that the Gentiles in their natural state had been abandoned. Basically, they were alienated from the life of God, having no hope and being without God in the world, is the way he said in Ephesians. And he's reminding them of this rich privilege that's theirs. As we've attempted to follow Paul's argument in chapter 11, we've seen that he argues for the existence of a remnant which has its roots in grace as opposed to works. And, of course, that's all the way in Romans. He's dealing with the whole issue of methodology in terms of relating to God and responding to truth. There are two basic methodologies, works and grace, or law and grace, works and faith. But the whole point there is that Paul is arguing in Romans 11 that God's words are true, even though there may be a large majority of the people to whom the promises were expressed who refuse to believe them and refuse to embrace them. That didn't rule out the legitimacy of the promises for anybody who would believe them. And so he's talking about this remnant according to grace, and the remnant concept in chapter 11 is specifically focused upon Israel in the form of the northern kingdom, because his whole illustration in chapter 11 is Elijah and his complaint against Israel. Well, Elijah was the prophet to the northern kingdom, and Israel was called the northern kingdom. And after the division of the Davidic kingdom into the northern and the southern kingdoms, Judah and Israel, that's the way they were referred to by the prophets from then on. There was Judah and there was Israel. And they were presented as sisters in an interesting kind of twist on reality. But nonetheless, the Davidic kingdom had been split because of Solomon's son's lack of wisdom. Solomon was a very wise king, and in dealing with the issues of his rule over Israel as a 12-tribe reality, he had extraordinary wisdom, wisdom beyond any human being's wisdom in terms of those kinds of requirements. It's well known that Solomon didn't have wisdom for the guy in the mirror, but he had enormous wisdom for the people that came before his judgment seat. But this issue of Elijah and Paul's use of Elijah in Israel as the northern kingdom is not solely focused on the northern kingdom, because in chapter 11, Paul calls upon David's imprecation when he asks for them to be bent over backwards forever and everything to be a trap and a snare and all that kind of thing. That was David's psalm of imprecation, and David wrote that long before the division of the kingdoms into Judah and Israel. So when he talks about Israel and uses the Elijah northern kingdom illustration, he's not saying that's the only application of this remnant of grace thing. The remnant of grace has been in the picture from the very beginning, actually. The whole point there is that he was trying to show that there is, in the word Israel, there is a distinction. There is a part of Israel that is hardened, and then there is a part of Israel that is a smaller group that's a remnant, according to grace. In Elijah's day, it was the 7,000 men who, because they believed in Yahweh, God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, or Israel, they refused to bow the knee to Baal. It's an interesting thing that Paul calls them the remnant that God has kept for himself, and the demonstration of the keeping was they didn't bow to this false god. So the point is, there was that part of Israel, a large part, that was hardened, and then there was the part called the elect, and they existed long before Elijah got into his complaint about the northern kingdom and the fact that they were trying to kill everybody that trusted in Yahweh. But as we pointed out last week, the category of people that Paul is addressing is not Israel per se, but my people, some of whom are called Israel, because that's the way he addressed it in the opening verse of the chapter. God has not rejected his people. And then he says, God hasn't rejected his people because I'm an Israelite, a descendant of Abraham. So his evidence is God hasn't rejected his people because he as an Israelite is one of those people of God. But we also looked at chapter 9, and long before chapter 11 in terms of our study, not very long if you're just reading through it. But the point is, he said in chapter 9 that my people was a category that was bigger than Israel. In fact, he said, I'm going to call those who have formerly been said not to be my people, I'm going to call them my people. And he talks about this my people category as those whom God has called, and not just us, but also the Jews and the Gentiles. So the my people category is a bigger category than just Israel. So as a group of human beings that are both Jewish and Gentile, the my people issue boils down to this remnant according to grace, but it's in a larger application because the remnant according to grace in the northern kingdom was 7,000 men who hadn't bowed the knees to Baal, but the remnant according to grace in the Davidic kingdom, before it was a Solomonic kingdom, there was a group within that kingdom that were elect according to grace. It didn't encompass the whole Davidic kingdom. Not everybody was a believer. And even before that, if you go all the way back to the Tower of Babel after the flood, you have God's dealings with Gentiles up until chapter 12, where God addresses Abraham and kind of narrows the focus down to Abraham, Isaac, Israel, and the 12 tribes. And from then on, it's kind of a focused thing. But even then, you have to address the fact that the Ninevites, as believers, they repented at the preaching of Jonah, became part of the my people category. So this my people thing is always going to eventually go back to this group that are the called. That's what Paul said in chapter 9. Those whom he has called, both of Jews and Gentiles. So after having identified the group, the larger category, as those who are called, made up of Jews and Gentiles, Paul goes into this root tree branch analogy. And I noticed in my editing of the study from last week that I erroneously made the statement that Abraham was the root. I said that two or three times, and it was wrong every time I said it. In the analogy of verse 16, you have the root and the branches, and the tree is just kind of ignored. It's the root and the branches. Well, in chapter 15 of Romans, Jesus is identified as the root. He is actually the root of the house of Jesse, but that just means that he was the originator from before David. And he is the root in Romans 15, in whom the Gentiles will trust. So if you go from root to branches, you don't have a real problem identifying the elements. But you have this tree that comes off this root, and it's the tree that produces the branches. And so in our analogy, I would argue that Jesus is the root, Abraham's the tree, and the branches are the offspring of Abraham. But the offspring of Abraham are identified in two different ways as in the category of my people. Because you have the offspring of Abraham that are physical genetic offspring that go down through the line of Isaac and Israel and the 12 tribes. And when you get down into the 12 tribes, and then each tribe is growing thousands and thousands of branches, most of them probably are not believers. But there are a group of believers in that flow of genetic links so that you can have a person who is of the circumcision of Abraham and of the faith of Abraham. That's Romans 4. And then you can have people who are the sons of Abraham in the non-genetic sense, where the Bible identifies a son as somebody who mimics the activity of someone else, and if the someone else is a precursor, then to follow his identity makes you a son of him. And that's the essence of the argument in John, where Jesus says to the Pharisees, I know you say you're Abraham's seed, but you're not, because you're trying to kill me, and Abraham didn't do that. You are of your father, the devil. And it doesn't mean there's a genetic link. It just means that you're following the example of this precursor called the devil, Satan. He's trying to kill me. You're trying to kill me. You must be his sons. So in the scriptures, you have this reality, and it's developed in Romans 4. Because in the background, well, I don't want to get ahead of myself, but in the background, you have the fact that God promised Abraham that he would not only make of him a great nation under the identity of Abram, exalted father. In Genesis 12, he says to Abram, I'm going to make of you a great nation. Well, then, and I think it's in Genesis 17, God changes his name to Abraham, which means a father of a multitude. And he says, as Abraham, I'm going to make you the father of many nations. And in Romans chapter 4, it says that Abraham became the heir of the world by faith, and he became the father of all of us who believe. So the real issue of being a child of Abraham is not the genetic link. There are issues with the genetic link, because he promised he'd make of him and of his offspring a great nation. That's going to be genetically developed. But he also promised this other category of sonship, where he's your father if you believe like he believed. If you exercise faith like Abraham exercised faith, you have become a son of that father. And in that category, there are all these nations that are made up of believers. And I think that's the essence of the judgment of the nations in Matthew, where Jesus says there's going to be goat nations and sheep nations, and what's going to make the difference between the goats and the sheep? Well, in the text of Matthew's statement, the difference is the way they treated Israel, but that's superficial. He says, inasmuch as you've done it to the least of these, my brethren, you've done it to me. So the sheep nation say, well, when did we ever see you in jail and go visit you? When did we see you hungry and we fed you? And he said, well, if you've done it to these, my brethren, you've done it to me. The goat nation say, well, you shouldn't be too hard on us. When did we ever see you in jail and didn't, you know? He said, well, you didn't do it to them. You didn't do it to me. But the issue of treatment is always going to be a secondary issue. The thing is, what's driving that treatment? And the thing that drives it is the faith that's underlying. And this is where I think everybody's going to go astray biblically if they do not realize that behavior is not the fundamental issue. What you love is fundamental. What you believe is intermixed with that. It's kind of hard to say, well, what comes first, the love or the faith? But love is the greatest. That's the primary driver. But faith is probably before the love, because in Peter's statement, you add in your faith this and this and this and this and this and this, and finally you get to love. So love is probably the last thing that's developed in terms of any significant real development, because it's the most difficult thing to change, but it doesn't change without you believing some things. So faith is there, and then love develops out of that. But those are the two things that's going to drive all behavior, and people who focus on behavior and ignore the love-faith issues are just like the Pharisees. They just totally ignored the motivations and the attitudes and all that. They just said, you haven't committed adultery if you haven't been in the sack with somebody else's wife. Or they just ignored the fact that, and Jesus came along and corrected that. He said, no, no, no. If you have desired it, if you looked with your eyes and desired it, you're guilty. So that's where he drove down to the driving force. Behavior is a driven reality. It's forced by the loves and the beliefs. So we need to keep that clearly in mind. The scriptures don't spiritualize the sonship issue. They just identify it as a reality based on you're copying the behavior of somebody. And that was established as early as Genesis before the flood. Because one of those guys had three sons, And those three sons are identified as everybody who was the son of this man was a worker in metal. And everybody who was a son of this man was a musician. And everybody who was a son of this man was a nomad. Well, you can't tell me that it was the genetics of this man that made all of his offspring workers in iron or metal. What he's saying is, if you're a musician, you're copying that guy who is a primary musician, and so you're his son. If you're into metallurgy and that kind of thing, you're copying the behavior of that first fellow that worked with metal, and you're his son by copying his behavior. And if you dwell in tents and have, you know, a nomad lifestyle, it's not your genetics that are making you the son of that guy. It's your copying his behavior that makes you the son. So the scriptures have been clear all along that there are two levels of sonship. One of them is the genetic connection, and the other is the mimic of the behavior connection. And we have to have that clearly in our minds, because technically that's exactly the way it works in the gospel. We are born genetically children of Adam, but we can become the children of God by faith in Jesus. That doesn't have to do with any alteration of our genes until the resurrection. And thank God we're going to have a resurrection that's going to change those genetics, because it's in the genetics that a lot of the sin is located. Because I think that that's the only way the fruit of the tree of could have corrupted humanity is by genetic corruption, DNA or whatever. Point is, you have this complication in chapter 11 of Romans, verse 17, where you have the statement, verse 16, that the branches are as holy as the root. And then in verse 17, you immediately have these branches that are being broken out, and other branches that are being grafted in that don't have anything to do with the tree. So if we take the analogy of Christ is the root, Abraham's the tree, the branches are the people, but there are two lines of the people. One of them is the genetics. That's the Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob Israel development genetically. And then there's the people who copied the faith of Abraham. And that's the other group within that. So given that, you can begin to understand that he is going to take some of the genetically developed branches off the tree because they lack the faith factor. So he's going to break those off. And then you have these people over here that are growing on this wild olive tree, and they have the faith thing, but they don't have the genetic link. And he's going to cut them off of that tree and plug them into this one by grafting them in. That's the big picture of the graphics. That's the whole issue. So the point is, you have in the scriptures this root and branch thing, and then Paul seems like he pulls in, as soon as he starts verse 17, he's pulling away from the big picture, where you have the root and then the final outcome, the branches that are holy. They're as holy as the root. Well, in between there is what we call the interim. That's in time. And it takes time in history for the holiness of the root to produce the tree, to produce the branches that will ultimately become all holy by the process of pruning and grafting. You have the fruit of the holy branches from the holy root, but in the meantime, in the interim period, it's a process. So that not every branch in the process is as holy as the root, or you wouldn't have to break it out, break it off. And you don't technically have to be connected genetically to the root. If you're from another tree and somebody takes you and grafts you into this tree, well, then you become a partaker of the root of this tree. But you didn't have any legitimacy there until you were grafted in. What Paul is doing in verse 17 is dealing with the processes. He has dealt with the ultimate end issues. He even talks about, in terms of the ultimate end, he talks about in verse 12, the riches that were promised to Abraham's offspring, the riches were going to be extended to the world and to the nations. But he doesn't say that that's going to happen immediately. It's a process where it's extended. And that's why you have the commission in Acts about being witnesses unto the uttermost parts of the earth, so that this whole thing can reach out to the people that are on the uttermost ends of the earth. And then in verse 15, you have this issue of reconciliation of the world. Well, that hadn't happened yet. It's a futuristic thing. And then at the end of verse 15, you have this life from the dead issue, which is the resurrection, which has not yet happened either. So what Paul is doing in verse 17, he's established the chief end, or the ultimate end. You have a holy root, you're going to have holy branches. But in the meantime, you have verse 17. Because in verse 17, you have two processes. One of them is cutting off branches that are in the tree, and the other one is you're grafting in branches that don't have any rightful place in that tree. They come from another tree. So there are, what, in a sense of contradiction in verse 16, to the roots are holy and so the branches are. Well, yeah, that's the way it's going to work out at the end. But in the meantime, you're going to have this tree producing unholy branches, and they're going to be broken off. And then you're going to have this wild olive that's producing holy branches because of faith, and they're going to be grafted in. And the whole issue is faith, because what he says in verse 20, they were broken off for their unbelief, but you stand by your faith. So you get to be in there because you believe. What did they believe? Well, Paul's talking to the Gentiles. What's he telling them? He's telling them, I brought you the gospel, which was for the Jew first and also to the Greek. I brought you the gospel, the promise of God of eternal life. By faith, you can actually become a partaker of the rich root, Jesus. And you have no genetic connection through Abraham for that. So the unholy natural branches are the Jews who grew out of the natural olive tree but were hardened, and they persisted in their refusal to believe, and they're constantly argumentative in attitude. And then you have the holy natural branches that are the Jews who are the elect, the remnant according to the election of grace. And then you have the holy unnatural branches of those Gentiles who are elected and called, but they don't belong to this tree, so they have to be cut out of the tree they're in and grafted into this tree, which the tree, as Abraham, is rooted in the identity of the promises that were made to Abraham. So this evening what we're going to do is we're going to look, for the rest of the time, we're going to look at the Gentile aspect of the holy branches with a view toward the significant danger that looms on the horizon of verse 18. So let's talk about the privilege that's extended. The privilege of being a participant in the richness of the root. That is extended in the context of God rejecting the natural branches who refuse to participate in the richness of the root because they won't believe. They are argumentative and persistent in their disbelief, refusal to believe. So, given the fact that they are argumentative and persistent, they get clipped out because they're not really participating in the richness of the root. So, it's in the light of that rejection that Paul is writing in verse 17. If some of the branches were broken off, well, yeah, the sum is actually a majority. A vast majority of the branches of the tree that consists of Abraham and the promises made to him, two promises, a nation and a multitude of nations, a name, Abram, and another name, Abraham. That's the tree, and that's the issue. And so the ones that are in the tree by natural generation, they're the children of the 12 tribe leaders that were the sons of Israel. They're in that tree in the sense of being part of the Abrahamic lineage, but they won't believe the truth. They are unbelievers. So, in light of the fact that if you're not going to believe the promises, you cannot participate in the root, even if you're directly tied to it. Even if the sap that's running from that root to you is running, you're not going to benefit from it because you will not believe. And that's where the mingling of the natural development by genetics and the issue of faith come together And again, that's in chapter 4. Paul argues in chapter 4 that Abraham received circumcision as a sign before the law was given. And the whole point there was that he received the covenant in uncircumcision, and then he received the circumcision as a sign of the covenant. So he is the father of the uncircumcised who believe in the promises, but he's also the father of the circumcised who believe in the promises. But the faith issue's got to be there. Because everything stands or falls on the basis of this faith principle. Because it's a fundamental principle of relationship. So, in chapter 11, verse 16, he says, if the root's holy, the branches are, but that's in the ultimate development. The rejection of God, of the branches that refuse to believe, is not a contradiction, it's a qualification. Some branches are not holy, and therefore must be broken off, so that the tree's holiness is actually generated and maintained. If everybody that grew out of Abraham's genetic background had become a believer, I mean, Isaac became a believer. He was the first son of promise. And Jacob was brought to faith by God's dealings with him, because he put him through the mill because he was a stiff-necked and deceitful guy. But God brought him to faith, and Jacob owned Yahweh as his God. And probably the 12 sons of Jacob, after his name was changed to Israel, all became believers, with some question about maybe Dan. But with Joseph's treatment of them, after the way they treated him, that's what brought them around. Because after Joseph's brothers sold him into slavery, their anger cooled. And then the regret and the shame set in. And they lived under that for years, while Joseph was being schooled by God in the school of prison and abuse and all that, till he was exalted under the Pharaoh in Egypt. It was when those men who had treated their brothers so badly were forced by God to go to Egypt to get something to eat, and Joseph was the guy that was in charge of all the eats. So they come before him, and they don't recognize him, but he recognizes them. And then he manipulates them. He engineers circumstances to heap the guilt on them. And by that, he brought them around. So they probably became believers. So here you have the beginning of this nation of believing people who are genetically tied to Abraham. But right off the bat, after the 12 men who formed the tribes, their children, lots and lots and lots of their children, never did show any indication of faith. And then when the kingdom split into the northern and the southern kingdom, the northern kingdom went into great apostasy. There were only 7,000 believers in the whole northern kingdom. And it was millions of people. Only 7,000. In Judah, the numbers were probably a little higher in terms of the number who believed, because the worship of Yahweh was still going on, at least when Judah had a decent king. But there were still a great number of people who were apostate in Judah. And you could tell it. As soon as a good king died, they went back to their idolatry. Well, those that did that were apostate. They weren't true believers. So you have this issue of qualification rather than contradiction. There is a process to getting the root and the branches to the same degree of holiness. And the breaking off of the unbelieving branches is a double intensified action, because the verb that's translated broken off is rare. I didn't write this down, but I think that this is the only place in the New Testament you find it. And it's a word that comes from the basic verb klio, and klio means, basically, it means to cry, to weep. But then you put ek in front of it, so it's ek klio, and the ek is a preposition and intensifies the weeping. So you have this form of intensified weeping, which generally means that the grief is piling up. You weep over bad things, and you really weep over really bad things. And then Paul added another ek in front of that. So it's ekklio. And that's a double intensification, which basically has, it forces us to come to this issue of somebody here is in deep grief. And it's translated broken off. Well, the breaking off can't be pleasant. So the picture is this. The grief of being broken off of the plant as a branch to the tree, you're broken off. You're not nicely sliced off. You're not comfortably removed by, you know, a sharp knife or cutter. You're just broken off. Well, what does that do to the branch? It creates significant amount of, if you put it in human terms, it creates a significant amount of pain. And that's the word breaking off. It's the one that means you're grieving a great big amount of grief because you've been cut off from this fatness of the root. And, of course, the problem in real terms with a person who is an unbeliever being severed from the community of those who do believe is a situation that causes rage initially. And that's the nature of the beast in the first century. Jesus comes on the scene. The vast majority of the leadership of Israel is apostate. And he lays into them. He tells them, you're apostate. You don't believe and you're the children of the devil and all those things. And instead of repenting and recognizing the truthfulness of his words, they get so angry they murder him. Well, that's the whole issue of the vast amount of pain that's involved. But there's pain on the other side, too. Because in the picture of Jesus being rejected by the branches of the first century manifestation of the tree, he comes on his way to Jerusalem to die for the sins of the people. And he gets to a place where he can see Jerusalem and he stops there. And that's the only place in the scripture where, no, it's not. But it's one of the places where he weeps. I think he weeps twice. Lazarus' grave, because Mary and Martha are crying. And he weeps over Jerusalem. He says, oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem. How often I would have gathered you as a hen gathers her chicks, but you would have none of it. And if you knew the day of your visitation. And so he's brought to tears. Well, that's the grief on the other side of the coin. So the grief of the rejected is great because they're losing out and their rage is very great. But the grief on the God side of the picture is he's losing too. And he weeps over the loss. So this verb that's translated broken off is a word that's just filled with this idea of violence, either of mind or action or both, but of the grief that it causes and the intensity of the pain that's involved here. And he says some of the branches were broken off. And that rejection is admitted in the face of both chapter 11, verse 1. Has God pushed his people away? No. But you have to be careful. It's his people we're talking about. And these people are not believing that are being broken out of the tree. They're not his people. So in the face of that, it's still true. These branches were broken off. God did reject them. In verse 11 of chapter 11, they didn't stumble so as to fall, did they? No. But you have to remember who he's talking about in terms of national Israel, in terms of no future. He says, yeah, they still have a future because there were certain promises made to a man who believed them. So the rejection is admitted. There is a real rejection and a real casting aside, but it's always of people who refuse to believe. They're argumentative in their very essence, and they absolutely are not going to buy into any declaration of the truth that doesn't let them be the God. So, it's not a contradiction, it's a qualification. The promises are valid, but they're not being fulfilled at the present time. It's like Hebrews 11 said, these all died having the promises, but not getting to experience the outcome of those promises. They died before they got the fulfillment. But physical death's not a big problem, because resurrection's a big solution. So it doesn't matter if you die before you get to see the fulfillment of the promise of God, because you're going to come back in the resurrected form, and then you'll have this fulfillment. So Abraham as a tree was promised the fatherhood of a great nation as Abram, and he was promised the fatherhood of a multitude of nations as Abraham. And as such, Abraham is viewed as the tree who is the father of us all. That's a phrase that's used in Romans 4:16. Abraham, who is the father of us all. National distinctions in relation to Israel as a nation are a subset. The my people are all of the people of God. But in the all people of God, there are several distinction issues. One of them is the Jew-Gentile distinction in terms of national identity. But even in our day, everybody who is a Gentile and everybody who is a Jew who believes in Jesus is neither Jew nor Gentile, but they are the church. So there is no national identity for the church. Interestingly, the church, once the kingdom of Messiah is set up and all of those sheep nations that have opportunity to be a part of Messiah's kingdom in the world, all those nations that are given a privileged position as nations in Messiah's kingdom, he's the King of Kings over all of them. But every one of those nations is going to be governed by members of the church. We're going to be the ones who call the shots for the nations. And Jesus made that very clear when he made the apostles that he chose the foundation for the church. But he said, in the regeneration, you guys are going to be sitting on the 12 thrones of the 12 tribes of Israel. So, I've said many times, we're going to be the sanctified bureaucrats. But that's what it means to rule and reign with Christ as a member of the church. We're not Jew and we're not Gentile. We're the church. Well, after the church thing's over and we go back to this national Israel thing in the tribulation period, the 70th week of Daniel, there are going to be nations that are relating to Israel as either goats or sheep. And they'll be brought to judgment based on how they relate. And then they'll have national identities in the Messiah's kingdom if they're sheep nations. If they're goat nations, they're out of there. So that's the big prophetic picture, and it's the explanation, I think, for some of the details. The reality in the present process time, where the process is working to bring from the root to the branch in terms of holiness, in the process in between, you have a partial rejection, you have a partial casting aside, but those partial realities don't mean the promises have been negated. It just means there's a process until you finally get to the ultimate reality of the fulfillment. In the ultimate reality, in the kingdom of Messiah, the root and the branches will be equally holy because the branches will take part in the holiness of the root. And the root's Jesus, and we're justified and sanctified and glorified in him. His righteousness is ours. So, that's the whole issue involved in this extension of the privilege. But it's extended in the form of a kind of harvesting. Because you have in verse 17 not only branches that were broken off, but the next thing is you, Gentiles, verse 13, being a wild olive, were grafted in among them, became partaker with them, with the branches that weren't broken off. So you have this kind of harvesting that's unnatural. You go over here to a wild olive and there are some branches in there that are holy. He's talking to the Gentiles. He's saying, look, when I brought the gospel of Jesus to you and you believed the gospel of Jesus Christ, you became holy because that's the promise. You're justified by faith. You get his righteousness attributed to you. Well, as soon as they became holy, they were part of this wild olive. They were Gentiles. Well, in terms of the my people category, fitting under Abraham's, the promises to Abraham, they're clipped off of that, and they're grafted in to the original holy tree. It's kind of an agricultural metaphor, but he said he was addressing the Gentiles as their apostle and messenger, and the imagery is, as a branch on a wild olive tree, you heard the gospel and believed it. Well, since faith is the issue, you get cut out of that one. And that probably was a fairly, you know, sharp knife slice. Not broken off, but brought over here and then grafted into this tree. And the imagery is that they get now to become participants of this root. And that's the next thing. It's presented as an extension of the offer of the privilege of being harvested out of your old olive tree or the wild olive and placed in the new one, into the legitimate tree. But it's also an offer that's extended to take place among the holy branches so that the wild olive branch becomes a fellow sharer. Verse 17 says, you were grafted in among them and became partaker with them. And then you have this phrase of the rich root of the olive tree. Actually, that's in a different order. In the Greek, it says you became partaker with them of the root of the fatness of the olive tree. Well, the root of the fatness of the tree is the right order, because the fatness is a word that is summarizing all of those terms that he started with in verse 11. By the transgression of the obstinate, hardened people, salvation came to the Gentiles. That's the big umbrella, salvation, all the benefits. And then in verse 17 or 12, he takes that salvation thing and develops it into riches for the world and riches for the nation. So this riches is underneath this salvation thing. And then he goes on down and he talks about the riches, the richness that is extended to the world, and he calls it reconciliation. So the real issue of the fatness, the riches, is this issue of being reconciled to God as your creator and redeemer. So now you have been joined together with the living God, so that life, the promise of eternal life, all of that richness is included. And that includes, in verse 15 at the end, life from the dead. So your ultimate destiny is resurrection into the fullness of the promise, which would be the fullness of the fatness of the root. So being the root of the fatness of the tree, the fatness of the tree is actually all the benefits. And the branches get to be a part of that. They get to produce all of the fatness of the tree in terms of its fruit production. But that fatness comes from this root. And that's the key issue in Romans 15, where Jesus is identified as the root in whom the Gentiles trust. They get to participate in all of this great, glorious thing called fatness. So the root is the basis for this richness of the fatness of the tree. And it's a characteristic of the good olive tree. The reason that this tree is different from that wild one is that wild one doesn't produce much. The cultivated one has been developed into a highly productive tree. And with Jesus as the root, and the tree as Abraham, and as the recipient of the promises, both of nation and nations, the fatness is salvation, riches, reconciliation, resurrection, all of those things. And the final picture is a new creation with Jesus as the King of the kings of the nations, with Abraham realizing his inheritance of the world, chapter 4, verse 13, by faith he was made heir of the world, and with the believers taking up their respective places in the nation, in the church, or in the nations. All of the people of God, from the beginning of history of humanity to the end, are divided up into subcategories, but every one of them is going to have their place in the kingdom of the King of Kings. They'll be plugged in, and they'll be able to participate in the richness of the tree. That leads us into verse 18, but we're not going to go there. We're just going to mention it. The verse 17 is an if statement that has a comma at the end of the verse. If this has happened, verse 18 says, don't be arrogant toward the branches, because there's a serious complication if you are. And we'll get into that next time, Lord willing.